welcome to Big Mouth, the new show where we pick over the bones of what's really happening in pop culture. Whether it's music or TV, film, books, internet, or to be confirmed, we'll look at what's good, what's bad, what's changing the world around it, and what it all means. My name's Andrew Harrison, and here with me today we have journalist Joe Muggs of Mixmag, The Guardian, Boiler Room TV, The Arts Desk. Is there anybody you don't work for, Joe?
Russia Today.
Russia Today. And you are available for things.
They asked.
Joe is Joe's very much the go-to guy for all things grime and dubstep, are you not? What's happening in these particular worlds? What can we expect next in the world of the grimes and the dubsteps?
Grimes and the dubsteps. Grime is in a state of fervent excitement because Skepta's album comes out next week, and this is the do-or-die time for grime and its breakthrough and its recent chart success and making chart hits on its own terms instead of having to capitulate to pop. So whether if Skepta's album is as hardcore as it promises to be, then grime will have a heck of a year. Dubstep has gone back underground. It's mysterious and smoky and for dark rooms again, as it always was at the beginning, which is nice.
Right. Nice. Dubstep, nice.
Nice.
Also with us, we have the writer, author and recovering music journalist and an all-round digital person, Sarah B. Hello, Sarah.
Hello. I'm not too bad, thank you.
Jolly good. As well as writing for the Melody Maker, Sarah has written everything from the acclaimed kids book The Yes,
yes,
to the official Glee Twitter stream. And you're also the co-creator of the astonishing book Drunk Furniture.
I cannot tell a lie. That is a true thing.
Which gives us insights into the thoughts of abandoned mattresses and shattered wardrobes around the London area. Yes?
Yes, yes, it does. In fact, all over the world. In fact, we had submissions from Los Angeles and Madrid and all kinds of sexy places where furniture has been spotted being somewhat worse for wear. And the trouble is now, like, we've infected everybody with this. It's like there's a plague of people just pointing at abandoned sofas and going and no one else knows why. It's quite embarrassing for them.
And also with us, as is here every week, on the Wheels of Steel and the Faders of Bakelite, it's Matt Hall. Hello, Matt.
Hello, Andrew.
Hello. Well, both Sarah and Joe are big Game of Thrones heads, and later on we'll be discussing the start of the new series, what does it all mean, where's it all going, plus also Captain America Civil War, which is coming out this week, and also that very angry news journalist that you might have seen on YouTube, Jonathan Pye. But first, it's been a very strange and a very sad week in the world of music. Right after we recorded last week's show, the news emerged of the very unexpected and very untimely death of Prince. In a few minutes, we'll be talking about what the world made of Prince's surprising and shocking departure, and we'll be asking, are we in the middle of some kind of great talent extinction event at the moment? But first, here's Prince at his best. Here is Pop Life.
What's the matter with your world? Was it all?
Prince with Pop Life. Now, there's been a lot of talk this week about Prince's talent and how it perhaps wasn't properly recognised until he was gone. But there's also been an awful lot of talk about how we're going to possibly have to get used to global talent dying, not of accidents or misadventure, but of old age and illness. Are we at some kind of a turning point for pop music? The shock for me, really, was I realised I'd only actually seen Prince once. I thought I'd seen a lot. And you kind of think, I should have taken the opportunity to go and see him when I could have done. Joe, did you see Prince? Did you?
Once and late.
Only once.
Only once and late. On the second round of his kind of big comeback recently, so three years ago maybe, at the Shepherd's Bush Empire, I think. Tremendous, absolutely brilliant. But yes, of course, I'm kicking myself over and over. You know, my wife went to see him on the Love Sexy tour at the absolute peak of his powers. Mm. And I would just glare at her with furious jealousy every day.
Yeah. Sarah, did you get to see
him? I did. I saw him thrice. At the O2. The first was, I was actually in a box, which was, I was writing for a tech site at the time, and so I had to go and be interested in some phones, and then as reward, I got to see Prince from a box in the O2. It was just wonderful, just sitting there going, it's Prince! I mean, that's the thing, he had such extraordinary presence that, you know, it was just being in a room with him was you know, one of those things you'll always remember. And then I also had tickets to see him, so I kind of moved further and further up, and eventually I'll just see what else I can get and end up right in the gods, which was, right. You know, which is not great at the O2,
you
but
look
still
at the top of Prince's head.
Could look at the top of Prince's head and what a lovely head it was. So yeah, but I'm kicking myself because I never went to any of the after shows, at which a friend of mine actually broke his leg dancing to Prince at one of the at one of the O2 after shows, and he regrets nothing. Such is the power of Prince, I think.
Do we just imagine that these great stars are going to be around forever, so there's always going to be a next time? You kind of think, oh, well, you know, it's a Tuesday night, I'm not sure I can bother going all that way, I'll try it next time.
Yeah, you can't, can you? It's too much of a risk. You have to appreciate them while they're here, and while you're, it's a real lesson to kind of learn to be in the moment, isn't it? Because it's no good, you know, I saw him three times, and, you know, I can complain about not having seen him at the Shepherd's Bush Empire, which I would have loved to have done, actually, Joe. But
I was sat between Alan Yentop and George Clinton.
Oh, well, that makes it Alan Yentop.
My name's Yentop and I am funky.
Well, it's a bit like Alan Yentop and George Clinton meeting in an elevator, isn't it, and producing techno music. Yeah. No, I can see that. Yeah, well, everybody was envious of. I mean, I saw him at Earl's Court on the Flying Bed tour, at a point where in the middle of the set, Prince just flies out over the audience on a bedstead with some beautiful women who are all kind of writhing around and being all princey. And you kind of think, yeah, you know, that's what a pop show ought to be.
Yeah.
But I'd imagine there'll be other chances, particularly I imagine, oh, you know, he'll be playing Glastonbury eventually. That'll be great, won't it?
Of course we imagined it with both him and with Bowie. I mean, they both seemed to be on the upward ascendant. They seemed to be kind of comfortable with their legacy and doing new things. And either of them could have gone on Leonard Cohen style, you know, for years to come.
It would have been great to see old Prince. What would old Prince be like?
Well, funky.
Yeah.
I think that's the thing. There are artists from much earlier, who had their kind of heyday much earlier, that are still around. Mm. Nobody's going, oh my God, I better rush and go and see McCartney or Chuck Berry, who's still playing. Mm. Why is this? Why are people getting kind of? I'm being a bit dissenting here, but why are people being so obsessed about Prince and Bowie?
I suppose partly because Prince was only 57 and we thought he had years left in the tank. And also, come back and ask that question when eventually, you know, Macca will die one day, and the week after it, the world will be full of people saying, I should have gone to see Macca when I had the chance.
And the same
with Chuck Berry, you know.
I am concerned. I've been listening to late period Macca and Paul Simon recently and going, this is good, this is actually good. Like with Prince, you know, he may have dropped off, but there was gems on every album. I'm going, these are talents that are still fully functional. And, you know, we may never get to see Joni Mitchell, you know, she's ill. She may never play again. I am starting to think about all these people, definitely.
Yeah. Just go and see them. You know, I went to see, I saw Paul Simon at Hyde Park a couple of years ago, doing the whole of Graceland. And it was just so wonderful, and his voice has hardly changed at all. You know, he really has this great youthfulness about him. But, you know, he is, what, 72 now, something like that? Mm.
So what do we think about this idea that we're kind of at the end of the Cretaceous period of rock and roll at the moment, that we're about to experience a large die-off? And in fact, we're probably in the middle of it, not just musicians, but obviously, you know, other very talented people. This year has been horrible for it. The kind of the theory is that there were a lot more ways to become famous in the 60s and 70s, and those people are now reaching the natural age of checking out, which is a dismal thought, isn't it?
There are some quite sort of banal and standard reasons for this kind of die-off, and it is, you know, baby boomers running out of steam, unfortunately, and, you know, it really is. I mean, so Prince died, and I did have that moment of disbelief, and then just this kind of, oh no, because it is what it, you know, that just coming so hard on the heels of Bowie as well, and it really, it's not just the death of the individual and the great loss that it is, it's the it's what it represents and what it symbolises, and it's like, that's not, and everybody kind of doing that whole, you know, I hate you, 2016. What are you doing? And it's like, we are going to have to get used to this. And, you know, you've got to get right with it.
It's the end of the beginning of mass media pop culture. Mm. I mean, they were the first generation really for whom, I mean, 50s, 60s, the first generation for whom pop culture actually pushed aside what was mainstream then and became the thing, the dominating thing, the global dominating thing.
Yeah. It's also with Bowie and Prince, the fact that they were artists, unlike the kind of previous generation of musical artists, who, if you were lucky, they were on Top of the Pops or kind of Ed Sullivan, or were shown kind of in a late night special on Whistle Test or whatever. All of a sudden you had artists who made videos and were inescapable. So they were everywhere. So when Alex Harvey dies or something, oh, it's a real shame.
Yeah.
But people actually didn't experience him to the same extent. I'm not saying that he was as big an artist, but they weren't so all encompassing and all pervasive
but
in their lives.
It's the end of a particular kind of artist, which is the pop polymath who could do everything, who could write, produce, play pretty much. I mean, it's a commonplace now to realise that if Prince had only been a guitarist, he would have been recognised as one of the world's greatest guitarists. If he'd only been a songwriter, he would have been recognised as one of the greatest songwriters. Because he was great at everything, he wasn't recognised for anything.
I think that's a bit down, and I think that actually, given that labels are kind of withering on the vine at the moment, I think you might find a whole new age of pop polymaths, because there's nothing to stop people doing stuff now if they want to do it. If they want to make a film on their laptop, they can. Yeah. If they want to be to make kind of a massive kind of five album opus, they can.
Well, I suppose, you know, everybody says, where's the modern Prince or Bowie? And of course, we've got him. It's Kanye West, and everybody hates him. Why does everybody hate him? You know, he's doing what you asked for. He's doing what you ordered, and you're moaning about it.
Oh well, but you do wonder though, who else is going to be able to emerge? There's kind of so much in the way of any of people, you know, of actually somebody else like that breaking through. There's probably another Prince out there right now who we may never even hear.
Well, but we're seeing Beyonce as auteur at the moment. I mean, she marshals this vast array of talent into this new album, and it is her vision, no question about that.
Yeah. Okay, well, R.I.P. Prince, but he was not the only great talent that died in the past few days. We've also lost the great Philadelphia soul voice, Billy Paul, who made it to 80 years old, which isn't quite a ripe old age, but it's certainly a decent innings. He's best known for Me and Mrs. Jones, but we would prefer to remember him like this. Here is Am I Black Enough For You?
Enough for you. Get in line. Start marching and jump.
Fantastic, Am I Black Enough For You? And Matt, you just explaining how that killed his career stone dead?
Yeah, basically it was released against his wishes as the follow-up to Me and Mrs. Jones. And apparently it just meant that all of the non-black radio stations in the States wouldn't touch him with a barge pole.
Well, Soho Radio will touch him with a barge pole. Pass that barge pole for Billy Paul.
And by morbid coincidence, I actually saw him. I saw Billy Paul once in my life, and as part of the recently deceased David Guest's Soul Spectacular 8 or 10 years ago.
Wow.
It was an extraordinary evening.
So essentially, Jay, you are the angel of death.
I'll take that one.
You're listening to Big Mouth on Soho Radio in an unrelated matter. Last week, while I was soaking up whatever the latest outbreak of internet anger was, I read someone saying they were so disgusted that I've run out of can't to even. That's when you can't even. It's an example of how the internet and social media is reforging the language, bending it out of shape. We've gone beyond LOL and OMG to new constructions. Sometimes they don't even make sense when they're spoken. They can be funny, they can also be incredibly infuriating. So how is the digital and the social world changing language, and is it a good thing? Sarah, do you find yourself talking like you post and talking like you tweet?
Yes, I do, quite a bit, yeah. I mean, I've worked as a sub-editor quite a lot, which means I've had to be a professional grammar Nazi. But as a writer, I love the sort of playfulness of language. This is how, you know, and I know it. I also quite enjoy how much it annoys people when, you know, I do, I can't help myself. I really like, you know, when you sort of twist things. But it's learn the rules and then learn how to break them or know when to break them. Yeah. And it's great. This is how you snap things apart, you put them back together, you jumble them up and you, you annoy your friends with it.
Do you have favourite coinages that have popped up? Should particular things?
At the moment, the thing is, there's always... There's always one that sort of overtakes my conversation, and at the moment this is it's sort of the follow. It seems to be the follow up to Doge,
Dog thing.
Doge.
Yes.
See, there is some argument as to how or not you pronounce how you pronounce it, but I'd say Doge maybe Doge.
My kids now call dogs Doges as a direct.
Really? Really?
I'm surprised that the dog in the back garden is not saying, you know, much grass. So smell. Yes.
Wow. But yes, there appears to be a thing called Bork Bork. You are doing me a frighten, which I believe you may be aware of, Joe. It's mostly it's generally dogs barking at each other, and there's the amusing pictures of dogs. One of them barking at another one that is looking a little bit, is doing that kind of side eye roll that dogs do. And the dog will be barking and saying, bork, bork. And the other one will be saying, my friend, you have done me a concern. Just like a dog expressing worry that another dog is barking. And it's like, am I doing, you know, somebody will be, if someone's irritated with me, I'll say, am I doing you a bother? It's just, and that annoys me even more.
So this is the kind of thing that people either love or it makes them turn into Simon Heffer and they want to smash the internet with a lump hammer. Joe, do you find yourself talking like you post at all?
No, not on the whole. I mean, I get enough gibberish from talking to toddlers anyway at home, so I don't speak teen speak yet. I guess who knows what happens when they get older, but yeah. I've heard teenagers abbreviating abbreviations. So what would be, when you see the abbreviation written down, saying CBA is too long.
I don't even know what CBA means.
Can't be asked.
Be asked to find out what it means.
Siebes.
Is that
Siebes,
like CBeebies?
It's like if you can't be asked to do something, it's just Siebes.
Oh, God.
And of course, a DGAF, but not radio friendly.
I do say Wevs quite a lot. I have got into a Wevs habit.
Oh, Wevs is awesome.
I love this because you know I have any pretensions to being a teenager at all. But I was incredibly uncool when I was a teenager. But this would have all been it would have taken me a long time to catch up with it. But yeah, it's great.
But you know, without wanting to come over all Melvin Bragg, you know, this is the fecundity of the English language. It is splendid.
You have just come over all Melvin Bragg.
It is truly splendid. I mean, you know, we have just been celebrating the 400th anniversary of Shakespeare's death. Yeah. And you know, what do we celebrate Shakespeare for? This list of incredible phrases that he made up, still in use today, commonplace language, many of them really silly.
Yes.
You know, he made up silly phrases. He played with
Romeo,
language.
Romeo, Webs.
Yeah. Yeah, so, well, this is the common argument that pops up. Well, if Shakespeare was around today, you know, he'd be a grime MC, or the sort of forcing things to be contemporary. One thing that I noticed was that the word hashtag itself was declared Children's Word of the Year 2015 by the Oxford University University Dictionary, saying hashtag is now a hashtag. And,
I wouldn't go that far, you see. I would definitely draw the line at that hashtag.
Yes. Well, saying hashtag anything seems to be a way to sort of pack a vast amount of meaning and association into not very many characters, not very many syllables.
Surely having something recognised by the Oxford University Dictionary is a way to kill it stone dead anyway, isn't it?
Well, yes, like Landfill Indy was killed stone dead by appearing in the Collins English Dictionary.
I remember seeing Kimberly from the Pussycat Dolls as a judge on Got to Dance on Sky.
Yeah.
Good show. Mm-hmm. And her use of hashtag swag as a compliment was so heartfelt. No, hashtag swag.
Hashtag swag.
Spoken in full. Wow. So it's not even an abbreviation, it's a lengthification.
I'm sure it was heartfelt. It also sounds mammothly stupid. I mean, did you not?
In context.
And probably highly scripted as well. At this point, you will say hashtag swag.
Such a cynic.
I'm old. Okay, well, that's hashtag. Enough of hashtag that. Let's move on. Something else you may have seen on the internet is the very angry, very sweary, very politically radical news journalist Jonathan Pye. Let's have a listen to Jonathan Pye.
Excuse me, how do you respond to revelations that your name has been linked to the Panama Papers? It's tested. Shit, no, it's not him. It's not him. It's not him. Walk away. So embarrassing. I hate this, Tim. I hate doorstepping and chasing people down the street like a madman. And it's cringeworthy. I could be chasing Idi Amin down the street and I'd still be rooting for him to get away. And why are we calling these revelations? Again, nothing's been revealed that we didn't know already. Of all the politicians I've interviewed and seen interviewed in the last few days, none of them seem even vaguely surprised by these revelations. It's just now we've got proof. We're all in it together, apparently. No. They're all in it together, OK? They're all on the inside. We're out on the street looking in. Hello? It's cold out here. Can we come in? We've got to pay tax out here. Oh, just a little bit of warmth, Governor. Yeah, just a few scraps for a little urchin with rickets and a substandard credit rating. They're all in it together. Russia, China, Iceland, Cameron's dad, FIFA.
You're listening to The Big Mouth Show on Soho Radio, and that was Jonathan Pye, a.k.a. the British comedian Tom Walker. You may have seen Jonathan Pye, the fake news journo, on YouTube or on Facebook, where he gets mad shares, 42,000 YouTube followers. He's clearly, or seems to be, based on the famous meltdown by a Thames TV reporter who signed off one report with the words, "This is Colin Baker for Thames News, Westminster, soaked with cold feet and an aching heart, terribly, terribly pissed off." Jonathan Pye is channeling that, but he has an agenda. He goes after the government and the bankers like a proper alternative comedian. But his worldview is, it's very much more conspiratorial. He's very popular with RT, formerly Russia Today, the channel which zealously advocates what it calls the alternative view. Is Jonathan Pye just pandering to kind of wet liberals like us and our prejudices? Is this a new way of doing alternative comedy? Or are we looking, Joe, at sinister Kremlin psyops? What do we think?
We're looking at sinister Kremlin. They took one look at Russell Brand and thought, stupid people will want something even stupider.
Right, they've weaponised Russell Brand.
They've weaponised Russell Brand. I mean, it's incoherent bilge.
Is it funny?
No.
Do other people laugh at it?
Not really. 42,000 followers is not very much for a viral sensation.
No, it's not, but actually the number of plays that he's got.
Yeah.
You know, like millions on Facebook, millions.
On occasion,
you know,
yeah.
I mean, yeah. I think it's a kind of an interesting... First of all, I mean, I'm not going to kind of stand here and defend him, but he started doing it, and then RT got involved with
it, apparently,
and started paying him. Which, the way he tells it, which I think is, if you're making something on the internet for no money, Andrew, it's really nice when somebody comes along and offers you cash. Are you listening, Mr. Putin? but you know, he's got a channel, and he's trying to make some money out of it. You can review the comedy, and you can have an opinion on the kind of method of delivery or the pipe that he uses. But I think that he's getting a lot of stick that isn't necessarily right.
Yeah. So, Sarah, what do you think? I mean, surely, if it's funny, it's funny.
I don't think it is that funny. I mean, just because, I mean, I don't think there's, you know, from what I've seen of him, he seems to be, you know, it's not very controversial stuff to me. I don't know. It's like, if you're going to talk about the Panama Papers, it's like, look at this corruption. It's like, well, yes. And I don't believe, I mean, I really think it's important to still get upset and angry about these things. But I'm not one of those people that, oh, I'm not. So who's surprised by this? Because that's a terrible perspective to have. But
The terminally unimpressed are really the plague of now, aren't they? Well, we've seen all this before. Maybe we haven't seen it all before.
Yeah. And also, you know, you should probably still, just because you're not shocked by it doesn't mean you shouldn't be angry, you know. But I just find Jonathan Pye, I think he's a bit, just a bit toothless, really. It's like, well, I know this stuff, and I don't really, I suppose I'm quite spoiled with a lot of, having a lot of very brilliant writer friends who can do this kind of thing a lot better on Facebook, which I know not everybody has. But yeah, it's like, just because it's true doesn't make it funny. You know, and I find it a little bit toothless, a little bit, you know.
I think understand he's got the appetite for it, 100%. Yeah. I understand.
Totally. I think it says as well, who else is doing that, even, you know, whether you regard it as funny or not, it's a form of satire, which I think maybe isn't getting... Mm. No, you know, other people aren't doing
it. It's pretty weak sauce, though, isn't it? The thing is, I do lie awake at night worrying about the death of satire, because the more absurd, you know, satire exists in the gap between reality and absurdity, and as that gap closes and closes and closes, it's like it becomes more and more difficult. And it's so important. Like, satire is something that we really need, and so it does make me, you know, it doesn't make me sad. I mean, I think he's got an ability. You know, he's got flow, you know. He can do
crazy,
a good rant.
Crazy flow.
I actually don't think he did. I mean, I watched his piece on the aftermath of the Paris attacks, and it was incoherent, to say the very least. It was just nonsense. So, likewise, his piece on bees and the environment. It was just some words. There wasn't actually any narrative.
There should be someone else doing this stuff. You know, who else is there?
The character that he is playing is
meant to be semi having a breakdown,
melting down an argument. And to me, that's the. I mean, I can't say it's the funniest thing I've ever seen, but the bit that I like are not the political stuff. It's the kind of portrayal of an incredibly depressed newsman permanently arguing with his producer. Again, perhaps not the most original character ever, but that seems to be where he gets to show off his comic skills.
The Valentine's one is quite... Have you seen the Valentine's Day one? Which is quite... It all comes out about his wife leaving him on a previous Valentine's Day and taking the slow cooker and the children and stuff. And so, but he's doing a piece with a stuffed bear holding a heart to camera. And it's so, you know... I think he is trying to expand it a little bit.
Well, what I find tiresome about it is it's actually just, it's not really looking for a laugh. It's looking for a pat on the back from its audience. You know, that kind of, you know, where people start clapping before they start laughing, because this is the stuff that they really, really agree with. A real comedy, you laugh uncontrollably, and it's often can be quite disturbing. It can go to the heart of what you believe or what you think is important. And this is kind of ingratiating stuff, saying to its audience of kind of angry, another angry voice subscribers and angry canary readers, yeah, this is what's really going on.
And it's a pat on the back for them as well, because it's saying, we all know this, don't we, guys? You know, this stuff is obvious. We are the ones who know it. I mean, you know, for all his manifold faults, Frankie Boyle does ask difficult questions. He does provoke. And you know,
but he's
totally
a much better comedian.
Yes, he absolutely is. He's a great writer. And you know, he may miss his targets as often as he hits them. But you know, there is genuine food for thought in what he does. You know, same with Jeremy Hardy, same with Mark Steele, who are the other ones that people...
I draw the line at Mark Steele.
I draw the line way above Frankie Boyle, to be honest. But that may be another discussion for
Frankie,
another day.
Frankie Boyle is there's definitely arguments to draw a line around him of led. But
if he is our champion, I think we're in worse trouble than we ever could have thought.
Okay, that's enough of that. Let's have some imperialist warmongering, shall we?
Yes,
Captain America Civil War. We're all terribly excited because this week we went to see Captain America Civil War. Matt couldn't come, but we went. This is the one where Captain America and Iron Man finally fall out and knock lumps out of one another and try to make a better movie than Batman versus Superman. Let's have a listen.
Captain, while a great many people see you as a hero, there are some who'd prefer the word vigilante. You've operated with unlimited power and no supervision. That's something the world can no longer tolerate.
I know how much Bucky means to you. Stay out of this one. Please. You'll only make this worse.
You saying you'll arrest me?
There will be consequences.
That was a clip from Captain America Civil War. Yes, all of your nerd Christmases have come at once this week, and not only a new Marvel movie, but also the return of Game of Thrones, which we'll be talking about in a bit. But first, did we enjoy Civil War?
I nibbled my fingers to the quick. I shed a tear at the Peggy bit.
Yes.
It was all
careful
there.
Careful with the spoilers.
There was a Peggy bit. I think it was a Peggy bit.
Mm. Yeah.
Peggy Carter of our own fantastic miniseries, which has been running on Fox. Sarah, you're our control here because you're not, unlike all of the fanboys in this room, not really a superheroes or Marvel type person, are you?
I'm not really. I mean, I've dabbled. But the thing is, my problem is really, I suppose, is that once I realised Batman existed, I couldn't really see the need for any other superhero. I'm afraid I'm a bit. I'm one of those. There must be more like me, surely.
Mm.
I quite enjoyed it. It was. I didn't realise how it is really long. We came out and you said it's really long, and I went, do you know what? I hadn't even noticed, so I must have enjoyed it. It was a solid outing, but I think it's kind of, from my perspective, it's kind of, I knew more or less who everybody was, but it's like it's a delivery system for some really crunchy, chunky, satisfying fight scenes, and of course the existential superhero angst of oh god, how can I deal with all of this power that I have and all of the responsibility. Which, you know, weighs very heavily upon all of these very sexy people.
Well, this is the interesting thing about Civil War is it's the philosophical one, because ultimately, and it's the political one, because what happens is that after a terrible superhero mishap, the government steps in and says, you, the Avengers, you're too dangerous to be out loose in the world on your own. You need to be regulated. You need to have some government regulation. And the surprise is that it's not star-spangled Captain America who says, yes, we need to line up with the government and trust the government. It's free-thinking, cheeky, self-made individualist, Ayn Rand in a metal suit, Iron Man, Tony Stark, who says, yes, we have to line up with the government, we have to trust the government, because we are walking weapons of mass destruction. And Captain America comes across more as a kind of John McCain figure than as the trust the government 1950s guy we thought he was. And this seems to be, this has sparked a lot of debate. Is it who's the liberals and who's the Republicans in this particular setup?
I think it's fantastic. I mean, it's also both of those seeming flips are in keeping with what's happened in the previous films. I mean, Captain America has been disenchanted by the conspiracies that reach to the heart of government, yes, of course. And
he's been listening to Jonathan Pye, hasn't he?
Tony Stark is growing up. We've seen him growing up, steadily falling in love, getting divorced, all of these things, which caused him to have regrets about his own individualist, selfish playboy past. So it's, there's this very personal twist to the political elements. It just plays with it. It plays with it through the film, and it doesn't give any easy answers, which is quite nice. I don't think anyone is let off the hook.
Yeah,
it's always, I took this choice because this was the thrust of my beliefs. But then it's quite messy at the end.
It is, and it's in sharp contrast to the, let's be honest, absolutely dreadful Batman versus Superman, which has the same premise. Millions of people have been killed in Metropolis because Superman had to fight General Zod. So Batman, Bruce Wayne, has to take down Superman because he's a threat. He can't be controlled. He is another weapon of mass destruction. And yet Batman versus Superman is so joyless, and the two characters are so one-dimensional. In Civil War, you get the sense that every single one of these crazy superhero characters has an interior life. They believe in something, and they have their own conflicts. And the thing that really made it compelling was nobody really wants to fight each other. They wish they were still friends, and they articulate this openly. You know, Captain America won't accept the regulation because his oldest friend, his only friend left from the Second World War, Bucky, is going to be prosecuted and possibly executed, and he can't let his friend go. And I found that such a kind of a believable thing. For a load of people are running around in melt suits and crazy costumes, they were more truthful, I thought.
But Marvel's always been that way. Marvel's always been the ones with the interior lives. That was what always stood it apart. And if you made the choice of Marvel or DC, you know, it was always you were kind of the sensitive souls, or maybe the creative souls, or whatever went for Marvel generally.
Well, we were talking about this earlier before we started the show today. That DC used to, that it's interesting the way that the two brands have fluctuated. That DC actually, at one point, when Batman After the Dark Knight Returns was published, actually had that much cooler kind of patina, and that all the cool kids were reading kind of DC and especially Vertigo stuff. And actually Marvel had got itself into kind of crossover hell, and you had to read 57 comics if you wanted to. You have to buy like 30 comics a month if you wanted to kind of actually be able to follow the plot. And I think that's the worry that I'm getting now about Marvel films, that, you know, very cold-eyed. They've introduced Black Panther in this new film. They've brought Spider-Man into the Avengers. They've got this, you know, in the same way as they did with Deadpool, they've got this massive kind of a spaceship crashed in the middle of Manhattan. You're starting to, you can't actually watch one Marvel film unless you've seen them all now.
Well, let's ask somebody who hasn't seen them all. Sarah B, let's go back to that. I mean, you mentioned that you could roughly tell what's gone. Did it seem like it was talking to somebody other than you, other than the general viewer?
Yeah, I mean, I figured, you know, this is not aimed at me. I am not the audience, and I wouldn't want it to be. I wouldn't want to be the reason. I wouldn't want to be the one person who is there. Everyone who knows all of this stuff having to sit through all the patronising stuff about who everyone is, and like, you remember this guy?
Yeah.
If you can avoid exposition in life generally and in drama, then you know that is a good thing. So I didn't mind, you know, having to kind of go, I'm not quite sure who that is, but you know. I think audiences of everything now are more too sophisticated to really just be satisfied with the very one-dimensional kind of... Well, I don't know. I mean, Michael Bay is still making films, so... But I think generally, you need the kind of existential, philosophical, you need that stuff in there now. Otherwise, people are going to lose interest.
And the stuff to talk about on the message boards or on Facebook or threads or whatever it might be. Sarah, what did you think? I mean, this is, I guess, is one of the tests. What did you think of the introduction of Spider-Man into it? Did you think it was like clanging and...
It was really funny sitting next to Andrew, and as soon as it was like, yeah, my secret weapon is in Queens, and Queens comes up on the... Andrew literally bouncing up and down in his seat next to
it. I was just like, I had tears in my eyes. It was just like, this is the best Spider-Man.
I did roll my eyes a little bit because I did find it a bit clangy, and also because they really played there's a spectacular fight scene where they basically destroy an airport in the middle of the film, which is great, but also, you know, they really played for laughs. So there is that kind of you know, are we having fun yet kind of superhero bants thing, which they really went for. Then it's like, look, we're mucking about, we're doing the funny thing, and Spidey did have the lion's share of that, and I was going, oh, please be quiet. And I know that he was supposed, that's kind of how it was supposed to be. But I do have I have a certain affection for Spider-Man. I saw the previous films, well, some of them, and I just think, what are you doing? You're kind of making him a parody of himself now.
But I really liked that, because when you watching it in parallel with Batman vs Superman, where there are no jokes, not one single joke,
not a bit.
And this is a movie featuring Superman, who's supposed to be the most optimistic character in the world of comics. Superman's superpower is not that he can punch buildings, you know, through the air and have heat vision. It's that he's a positive guy who never gives up. He brings out the best in you. And in Zack Snyder's movie, he is grim and he's dull and he's as gritty as Batman. And you're kind of thinking, what is the contrast here? In Civil War, I loved the fact that this massive fight is underscored by Spider-Man insisting on wisecracking and really getting on the
nerves. That's what he's always done, though.
Yeah,
that's what the character's always done. You know, when you read the Spider-Man comics, they were the first comics that I ever got into. It was basically because, you know, he was like getting beaten up by Sandman, but they'd always be kind of a witty,
bungling Spidey. I wasn't quite sure. You know, it reminded me too much of Kick-Ass, to be honest, which I did love, and now I think I can never watch again because it's a bit too violent, even for me. And I'm fine with it.
I think Kick-Ass is a really cynical film. And comic, and Spider-Man is fundamentally not cynical. I mean, both Spider-Man and Ant-Man are the comic relief in this massive fight, and they're just so funny because it winds up their antagonist so much that you kind of get the sense that it's not just a bunch of square jaws knocking lumps out of each other. There's some human beings inside these preposterous outfits.
I can't wait to see what happens. Don't tell me what happens to Hawkeye, who is my favourite superhero of all time, because he's so rubbish. He's just a bloke who can fire arrows.
Yeah, I just think of him as Matey out of Queens of the Stone Age.
Fantastic.
Well, the naked one with the beard.
One thing that, you know, whenever a giant superhero movie comes out, a serious film critic will pop up and say and moan about giant superhero movies, and, you know, this is what the culture has come to. But this is some of the best popular cinema around at the moment, isn't it? This is what great popular filmmaking should be. Big events and characters that you care about. Where does the snobbery come from? Is it just because it happens to be long underwear characters?
I think the thing is, you know, you can end up coasting when you have so much goodwill and so much familiarity already made. I think it's very easy for filmmakers to kind of coast on that. So they still have to be vigilant. It's like you can't just let that do the work for you. You have to actually, you know, so it's like, you know, you still have to make a good movie. And I think it was a good movie.
They all read Guy Debord at university, and they all still think that the society of the spectacle means evil, and therefore the bigger the spectacle, the more evil it is. Mm. And some people are just anti-fun.
Yes. Well, I'm very pro-fun. I think we're very pro-fun on this show. And moving to the other pole of geekiness, we live in a geeky world. Well, this week, Game of Thrones returned. No superhero costumes, but plenty of swords and sorcery. Viz Top Tips this week said you can save money on your Sky Atlantic subscription by just watching Lord of the Rings and then pausing every 10 minutes to watch some porn, sword, sorcery and nudity. What does the massive success of Game of Thrones say about now, what we want from entertainment, and specifically in a room full of Game of Thrones freaks? What do we want from this series? We'll do a bit of a spoilery bit at the end, but we'll warn you first. Sarah, you are a committed Game of Thrones head.
Yes,
what,
I am.
What is the sword and sorcery show that people who would never enjoy sword and sorcery enjoy? What has taken it to a wider audience?
It's because it's a great feat of sort of narrative engineering, and in a way that all of the things, all of the dragons, all the things that people kind of roll their eyes about, is all there. It's all in there for a reason. It all serves a purpose, and it's not overplayed. I know people talk about the maybe we'll get on to the gratuitous nudity. Mm. I don't think it is gratuitous, but we'll get on to that.
That's how it
is. But yes, what's the broader appeal? I think it's that people realise, and I've seen this happen where they've gone, oh God, this is, look at the state of this. But then when they it has grabbed them, because they realise that the story is basically the story of humanity. It's the story of you know, all these great, it's the grand themes that it's another playing out of, you know, you've seen this done countless times before, but it's done so well and so powerfully that I think it just wins them over.
I agree. I think it's a depiction of what people are really like in a world where power is more important than law, where, you know, it is not exactly pre-civilized, but it's a very early stage of civilization where might is right, and it brings out the best and the worst in people, irrespective of dragons, witches, etc.
Mainly the worst.
Yeah. But occasionally the best, and you are often surprised at who sort of steps up to the plate with their giant broadsword. What hook you, Joe?
Dragons and tits.
In that order.
I'm a dweeb. I play Dungeons and Dragons at school, you know.
You think it's a documentary, don't you?
I do think it's a documentary. I'm semi-convinced that this is what New Zealand is actually like. No, Croatia, wherever it is. That's New Zealand's
well,
the other one,
isn't it? Certainly like that, yeah.
Yeah. Again, I like spectacle, and I like a romp, and I've always wanted things that can properly depict politics in the small p. This is how the business of power is negotiated, and so few things ever do it. You know, The Wire did it, Sopranos did it, almost nothing else did. I'll be honest, I'm starting to find Game of Thrones a bit silly. It's not turning me off it. I mean, maybe just the multiple layers and the magic faraway tree that presumably will come back at some point in this series. And,
oh, where Bran has climbed up the tree.
I think
he might have been dropped in the memory hole, actually. I wouldn't,
There are certain magic plot holes that do render it fairly silly at points. But even so, you know, it still has that buzz of this is how the negotiation of enormous power and the manipulation of thousands of people actually work. And I think that the appetite for it is actually going back to Jonathan Pye, is people want to understand this stuff.
Yes.
They don't want to understand it in their day-to-day political life, in our politics. They want to believe that our politics are driven fundamentally by principles and ideas and clean things that you can understand. They don't want to think that it's dirty and manipulative and so on.
But isn't it also like, you were talking about spectacle earlier, if you've ever wondered what it's like to see a dragon attacking a
goat.
Well, I was going to say a circus full of people. You actually get to see it because it is actually, you know, it's the complete antithesis of Blake Seven, of kind of like half a dozen people running around a quarry somewhere.
Hang on.
But, you know,
those were amazing scripts, Matt.
Yes, but the visualization of the actual scripts was always hampered by the fact they only had enough money for the hire of a quarry somewhere
and
in Surrey.
And wearing Hot Gossip's outfits from last
week. Yeah, precisely. Yes. Whereas this, you actually see, if you ever wondered what you thought a horde of horsemen, the Dothraki sweeping down on a defenceless city looked like, you get to see it, you know.
I think the thing is, as well, with Game of Thrones, is that you do get out of it what you put in. It's a very demanding show, but it's very it gives you such a lot. The more it's very rich. You can get a lot out of it. You can really analyze it. And it's because I've been watching the whole thing again with my boyfriend who kind of eventually went, all right, let's watch it. He can't even with Game of Thrones. Every episode finishes, he sits back and goes, because it exhausts him. It's like, but you can't. And then we'll kind of talk about it for sort of half an hour, and it's kind of, you know, you can take any sort of two of the major characters and sort of set them against each other and go, do you realise the connections here? Do you realise that the parallels in this one seems to be good, but look at what they're doing, it's no different to what they're doing. And it's you know, it's this incredible sort of multi-dimensional moral framework which you can really
I think that's the other interesting thing this series is going to be to see what the guys who are writing the show are going to do with it now that they don't have to follow the books. That actually, is it going to be, you know, was the faraway tree really ridiculous? Was that in the book? I can't remember. But, you know, are they going to simplify it and make it more kind of, you know, more serious story arc that you would get in any other kind of HBO mega budget production, or is it going to
stay as layer upon layer?
I'm a little bit worried about that, to be honest. I'm worried that there's this great engine that's been driving it, which is the books, and obviously George R. R. Martin is still he's still executive producing, and he has told Benioff and Weiss how it's all going to end, apparently. So just in case he snuffs it before they can finish it. But I'm slightly worried that there will be a shift in the balance of where the story is kind of coming from, and that it's, you know, we're into season six now, so there's quite a lot of you can get. I noticed in season five there's quite a bit of a little bit of complacency coming in, a bit of fatigue coming in, and you know, I worry. I mean, you know, I'm quite philosophical about it because it's been so great up to now, so you know, I'm bracing myself for it to start to kind of slacken off a bit, I think.
Well, they've got 10 times the budget for this series that they had for the first series.
Really?
So there's going to be a lot more whiz bang pow. We know this.
Yeah. Okay. You mentioned a minute ago the relation between politics in Game of Thrones and what people want from politics in the real world. The High Sparrow is Jeremy Corbyn, isn't he? He just is Jeremy Corbyn. He's this serene figure surrounded by much more, shall we say, zealous characters, perhaps a bit more unscrupulous than he. And he kind of floats above the whole thing, dispensing his platitudes, being bald. He is, isn't he?
And getting people to beat the politicians through the streets shouting shame. I mean, you know...
Corbyn's actually done that yet, but he would like to do that to Tony Blair, wouldn't he?
He really would. That is the very mentality that you know, the other politicians are the decadent ones. You know, yes, the Lannisters are decadent, but this puritanical backlash is something that has happened again and again and again in history. I mean, George R. R. Martin knows his history; he really does.
Yeah, and he's kind of cherry picked from here, there, and everywhere. I mean, people talk about Game of Thrones as you know, the shorthand for it is medieval, because you know, in some ways it has some of those trappings. But what it actually is more early modern. You know, the sort of the technology that they have, the way that society works, is actually it's further on than that. But what another thing that I love about it is that there are many, many sort of situations that are, you know, analogous to things in the real world, but not directly, not completely. Yeah. So it's not that kind of lazy thing of going, oh, here they are, they're playing out the American... American Civil War, or they're playing out the this election or that thing. It's all kind of fragmented and put back together in a in this extremely pleasing way.
Okay, well, we're slightly running tight for time here. What do we think we're going to get from this series? I mean, here's spoilers, like, turn your headphones off now quickly. Jon Snow's clearly not dead, is he? He's going to be resurrected.
Clearly not yet. The Red Woman will do it, I expect.
And we were quite shocked by the Red Woman's revelation at the end of the last episode.
Slightly clunky prosthetics there, I thought, but
they did the same thing apparently that they did with Cersei's Walk of Shame, where it was a body double with her face. With I thought they were pretty good, actually. I found it very sort of poignant. I know it's supposed to be like, oh no, the hot woman is not actually, but
trade as a Britt Eklund's bottom.
Really? Good lord. Well, I think that's you're right about that, in that you know, every single, even the most horrible character in Game of Thrones has got a poignant side to them.
Yeah, there's a vulnerability to all of them.
Arya Stark, it's Daredevil, isn't it? She's the blind warrior.
She's going to be all right.
She's
going to be all right.
Thing, yes.
Yeah.
Set up a law firm with Foggy Nelson.
I think she'll probably get. Yeah, I mean, I would expect her to somehow get her sight back, or just transcend it so it doesn't actually matter that she's blind.
Well, actually, I like this actually from the book, aren't they? Because they're kind of like, the story is kind of like a little bit delayed in the book. So actually, what happens to Arya in the book is still happening. That hasn't finished yet.
Right. I have to say, I'm so glad that, not that I ever ran into any trouble with this, but all the kind of book snobs going, oh, of course, well, if you'd read the books, you'd realise that spoiler. And now it's like people will be able to turn around and go, aha!
Yes.
Come here. No, la, la, la.
And just finally on this, I mean, what I love about it is you're never sure whose story you're watching. You think, you the first season, you think you're seeing the story of Ned Stark, and suddenly you're not. Mm-hmm. Yet then you think you're seeing the story of Jon Snow, and you're not. I'm beginning to suspect that the overarching thing is Sansa Stark, that it's actually all about her. That it's, when you look at it, just as you could look back at Mad Men and see that it was in a lot of ways the story of Betty Draper, that Game of Thrones is really the story of Sansa Stark.
She's certainly the one who's changed the most.
Yeah.
And has had the most development, and, you know, for various extremely ugly reasons, had the ways of the world kind of shown to her.
Yeah. Or maybe it's all just about Brienne and her big sword. Because she's the best one, isn't she?
I reckon Theon.
Yeah, Theon.
At the end of the series, it's going to be Theon on the on the Iron Throne.
I think, you know, I think it'll probably be Baelish. I think he's going to come out on top and show everyone what he was made of.
You don't think it'll be Swiss Tony who's in love with the Khaleesi?
We could be here all day. We'll doubtless be returning to this subject in later shows as the series develops. We're going to finish, as we do every week, with Closing Time Chatter, where our guests talk about something that's obsessing them at the moment, the thing that is filling their brain. Sarah, what's obsessing you at the moment?
Well, I have got, there's three things, which are three amazing American comedies which are coming back this week, which are Silicon Valley and Veep and Broad City, which are just three of my favourite things that have happened in the last few years. They're all absolutely brilliant. Silicon Valley, I mean, I can't tell you which one I'm looking forward to most because I just love all of them.
I think a lot of people are quite familiar with Veep, probably less so with Silicon Valley, but Broad City is quite a mystery to a lot of people. Give us the quick pitch.
Broad City, okay, it's the perfect midpoint between Girls and the Young Ones.
Ooh.
Wow.
I would say, oh, look at everyone's face. Like, oh, no, it's really wonderful. It's something that, I mean, I don't think it's necessarily a good thing to see. Hey, look, it's girls doing what you've seen boys do a lot. So it is. It's basically a stoner comedy, which, you know, if you'd presented this to me, I would have gone, God, no, this is really not my thing at all. But it's so anarchic and so gleeful and so kind of feminine. It's just these two very charming women just careering around New York, getting into ridiculous adventures, and it's hysterically funny.
If I love Dude Where's My Car, and God, I'm revealing my taste to be shallow today, but if I love Dude Where's My Car, will I love this?
I don't. Do you know what? I never caught Dude Where's My Car. Although,
if you think that Harold and Kumar are the two, is the apotheosis of.
But it's not that. It's not that stoner. Maybe it's a post stoner comedy. But I mean, they do smoke a lot of weed and are extremely silly. So you know, I have to say that that was the greatest sequel title ever.
Seriously, Dude Where's My Car.
Seriously, Dude Where's My Car.
Broad City was described to me as if they did Two Broke Girls right and it was funny.
Yes, exactly. I really wanted to like Two Broke Girls, and then of course I couldn't because it was awful. But I mean, they were again two very charming women, and they just the scripts were terrible, and it was, you know, terribly racist and stuff. So yeah, but yeah, Broad City, two Broke Girls for people who couldn't stand Two Broke Girls.
Let's have a quick listen.
Ab, ab, ab. No joke. Today is the day we become Abby and Alana, the boss bitches we are in our minds. Are you with me?
Yeah, I'm with you. Awesome. Are you done? Is that the whole thing?
Obviously, I have a plan. Tonight, we are going to see a secret pop-up Lil Wayne concert at Bowery Ballroom.
You know, I can't. I'm so broke.
No excuses, girl. I'm getting big old balls and mozzarella today. Get it. Harder.
You're going to have to speak in English for me.
I'm getting my paycheck today and I can spot you, bitch.
I wish that I could, but I'm so close to finishing season one of Damages. And I made this, like, amazing cashew stir fry for the week, so I'm actually pretty booked.
Stir fry? Can I talk to the Abby who stole a van?
Ab, you're so stuck in your little routine. I bet you schedule when you jack off. Schedule when I... Oh my God, is that Lincoln?
Yep.
Is he inside of you?
Yep.
I'm just keeping him warm.
Joe, what's obsessing you at the minute?
I am overjoyed this week because I have finally secured my time off and my plane ticket and my ticket to go to Sonar Festival in June in Barcelona. And this is my way of doing music these days as someone who's getting on and, you know, is a little bit mud-averse. So it's not, I am going to Glastonbury this year, actually, but the City Festival.
Yeah.
I do not understand why there is not more excitement about the number of city festivals that are available throughout the year. It seems to me to be the most civilised way to consume music. The daytime event has moved to a bigger kind of massive hall thing, but it was previously in the Barcelona equivalent of Tate Modern.
Yeah.
To get this beautiful air-conditioned, architecturally perfect building in the daytime, and then, you know, a massive rave on the outskirts in the evening, and at any time you're within a very short taxi ride or even walking distance of all the tourist stuff and the Miro Museum and the market to buy enormous hams and all the rest of it. You know, this is civilized.
It's sold out already, has it? Really? So if you want your enormous hams, it's too late. Has it sold out?
The hams?
Not the hams. They've got infinite hams in Spain.
I've got a vision of people out of like vendors outside the gates to the festival, going like,
yeah.
"Get your bocadillos here."
Yeah, yeah. 6 a.m. People
saddling up to you, going, "What? Got any ham? Got any ham on me? Got some H?" Wants a J. Got H'd up. My personal obsession at the minute, as someone who never leaves the house, is a fantastic comic called Descender, which is essentially the film AI with a brain and with more scope and more excitement and more spectacle. A little robot boy has to find his way in a very, very hostile universe. It's brilliant. It's terribly exciting. Joe's wife, Natasha, introduced me to it, and it was a good call, that one. So thank you, everyone, for joining us. Thanks to Joe Muggs and to Sarah B, and, of course, to Matt with the knobs and the faders. You can hear us again online at audioboom.com. Search for Big Mouth. You can also subscribe to us on iTunes. Please do. It helps us get up the charts. Otherwise, we'll be here next week with the Big Mouth Show. Thanks for listening, and thanks to our guests.
Thank you very much.
Cheers.